For Deborah Laurie, it happened as soon as she flew solo for the first time. For Beverly Bass, it was the second she saw a plane take off into the sky. Those were the moments where Deborah and Beverly decided they would be pilots, no matter what it took. And they both got there. Deborah was the first female pilot with a major Australian airline, and Beverly was one of the first female captains in the US. But that journey certainly wasn't easy, and September 11, 2001 was a key turning point on the way. Deborah and Beverly, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hilary.
Deborah, let's start with you. Tell us about the moment when you first flew a plane solo.
I first flew solo about a year after my first flying lesson, because I only had a lesson a month because I was paying for them myself and it was quite expensive. And that happened in April of 1970 when I was 16, nearly 17.
That is an amazing thing for most of us to think about, having paid for our own flying lessons for a year and still being 16 when we took over the controls on our own. Were you scared?
No, not at that time, no. Because I had a very good instructor and he had taught me very well.
And what were your feelings as you took off?
Getting airborne, it's quite a strange feeling, because up until that time you've always had someone sitting next to you and helping you and teaching you. And so it is a sudden feeling of being very alone and having to get the aeroplane down all by yourself. So I was concentrating very hard.
And what was it like when you had your first lesson? Did you have that confidence then as well?
When I had my first lesson, no, I actually didn't like it. I felt very awkward as a 16-year-old girl and in a very strange environment. And I really only continued with lessons to show my father that I could go solo.
So
that was my aim.
He was encouraging you to fly?
He did it himself as a hobby, and I went along helping him learn his checklists. And being the eldest child and quite close to him, I wanted to do things with him, and that was one of the things that we did together.
And what was it like at that time? Because this is the late 60s or 1970. I can't imagine there were many female pilot role models for you to look up to, Deborah.
There were ladies who were flying light aircraft or small aircraft, and I did become a member of the Australian Women Pilots Association, but there were no ladies who were flying large airliner aircraft at that stage.
And so did you always think to yourself, I'm going to do that one day?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I can't see it, but I'm going to be it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, it was the logical step.
And Beverly, what about you? How did you first get that germ of an idea that you wanted to fly a plane?
Well, you know, very similar to what Deborah says. You know, for me, it did start very young. I told my parents when I was 8 years old that I wanted to be a pilot, and I'm sure they thought that they had a crazy kid. Maybe they did, but I never lost that desire. And I wanted to start taking lessons when I was 16, but we were very involved in raising quarter horses and showing, and we did that as a family. I'm an only child, and I think my dad didn't want me to lose interest in the horses. So even though they supported me in everything I did, he wouldn't let me start flying lessons. So when I left for college, we sold the ranch. I came home, and it was my first summer home after my freshman year at college in Texas. And I drove my car to the local airport in Fort Myers, Florida, which is where I was raised, and signed up for flight lessons, took my first lesson, came home and walked into my parents' house and said, I'm going to fly for the rest of my life. And I did.
And what did they say? Let's sit down and talk about this.
No, I think they believed me. They knew they had a very stubborn child, and nobody was going to tell me no. Nobody was going to stand in the way. And, you know, like Deborah, there weren't any, we didn't have mentors. We didn't have any women airline pilots that we could talk to. And, you know, we just pursued it ourselves, and we were very determined and just did what we had to do to make it happen.
I love how you've talked before about how your father thought the quarter horses would keep you away from boys and drugs. Did the
yes.
planes have the same effect?
I think by then he realized that he had gotten me through high school and I didn't get in any major trouble or anything. So I think he felt like he had accomplish what he set out to do with the horse operation.
And how did your first plane ride feel, Beverly? Why was it so addictive?
Oh, you know, the first time you kind of feel like there are so many things to learn and so many things to master that you just feel like, oh my gosh, will I ever be able to do this? And then after you fly 8 or 10 hours, which is usually when your instructor gets out of the airplane and says, okay, I want you to go make 3 takeoffs and landings by yourself. And it is such a daunting feeling, but once you, you know, make your first touch and go, you land and take off again, you think, oh yeah, I really can do this. And it's just so rewarding and such a feeling of accomplishment. And you want more, you keep going back for more.
And I imagine the intellectual challenge must be quite big. You've got a lot of things to think about to keep the plane in the air and stay on course. But is there time to enjoy the sensations as well?
Oh, for sure. And that, you know, that even happens today. You know, I'm still flying a private jet today. And the other pilot and I will often say, after all these years, I mean, we've been pilots for almost 50 years. And we think, gosh, can you believe we still get to do this? We still get to look out the front window and have a view that really only a few people in the world ever get to do in their lives. So it's a great feeling even today.
I was reading how you were juggling study and going out to the airport from 3 till 9 p.m. each day to do your flying. So you were clearly very dedicated even at that young age.
Yes, I scheduled all of my classes in the morning in college. And then as soon as I finished, I got in my car and drove to the airport. And you're right, I would stay till about 9 at night. I went through 4 years of college and never had a date or went to a party. So I was pretty dedicated to my flying.
Tell us about your first flying job, Beverly, because it was a little unconventional.
It was. And I really only got the job because the guys didn't want to do it. My first flying job was flying bodies for a mortician. And the gentleman who owned the airplane kept it at our flight school. And he was a mortician. He embalmed bodies. He didn't own a funeral home. He just did the embalming. So all of the bodies that I flew, of which you could only fit one in the airplane at a time because the cargo door was so small, they weren't even in a casket. They were just on a stretcher with a sheet over them. And so I would have to climb over their face to get to my seat. And I was very proud of the job because it was the first time that somebody was paying me to fly an airplane. And I was very lucky. My parents did pay for my flying lessons, but I was so proud when I was actually being rewarded for flying and somebody was paying me and I wasn't having to pay for the airplane. So it was great.
We're chatting with two amazing female pilots. Beverly Bass was one of the first female captains in the US, and Deborah Laurie was the first female pilot with a major Australian airline. And Deborah, so you caught the flying bug, you started logging your hours, and just ahead of making Australian legal and political history, what did you do when you started applying to airlines?
Well, I put in an application just as all the other guys at the airport were doing, and the response I got was, thank you very much, and could you just update us when you get some more hours? And this sort of routine went on for several months, and in those days there was a cutoff age of 27, and even though it was a few years down the track, it seemed as if the airline didn't know how to handle me and they were just going to delay me until I perhaps reached the age of 27.
Because you'd logged a few hours by then already, hadn't you? About 2,500?
Yes, I was working as a flying instructor and also secondary school teacher. So I was doing two jobs, as we all do. And so I'd got quite a few hours up teaching flying.
So you eventually got an interview. What happened there?
I had the interview. I was sent off to do psychological tests, and those results turned out to be quite good. And so I was quite hopeful that I was going to be selected. And then I received a letter to say that I'd been rejected outright.
And so you made a decision that had some big ramifications. What happened then?
At that time, the Equal Opportunity Act had just been passed, and I thought it would be a good idea to go and have a chat to the Commissioner for Equal Opportunity, and I said, look, I feel that there may have been discrimination in my case. And she actually contacted Reg Ansett at the time. And after that phone call, she was left in no doubt that there possibly was had been discrimination.
Because Reg had some pretty firm views on women as pilots, didn't he?
Yeah, he didn't want them on his aircraft, that's for sure.
Well, and during the court case, Ansett made some pretty amazing suggestions as to why women might be unsuitable for flying. What were those ideas?
Oh, we wouldn't be strong enough. We would panic. We'd go strange, act strangely every month, all sorts of different things. But it was mainly a lack of suitability due to our disposition and anything associated with being female. But Ansett lost at every stage during this court case. And when it eventually ended up in the High Court under appeal, they openly admitted that they had discriminated, but they were going to rely on the federal law to overrule the state equal opportunity law.
What kind of public response were you getting at this point when these amazing ideas were being aired? Things like their earrings will get in the way. How were people reacting to that?
Well, most women thought it was rather crazy. I mean, you've got guys saying your earrings are going to be an issue if you ever have to try and get out of an aeroplane. Now, mind you, I've never got out of an aeroplane and I don't intend to try and go out the window or anything like that. But they were unaware that you could actually take these things off. They thought they were fixtures of some sort to your permanently in your ear. So anyway, it was a surprise to them.
So the case went to the High Court and you did end up flying for Ansett for a period. What was it like working for them, though, when clearly the culture was so set against having women there?
That was the culture in management or at the top of the company. It wasn't the culture necessarily with all the guys that were the pilots at the time. And because I started out on the most junior aircraft, if you like, so I'd had the most junior captains, those guys were actually really very, very good to me. There was the odd one or two that were disapproving, but in the majority they were very, very helpful. And it was just a few months after I started with Ansett that the ownership of the company changed and Reg Ansett was no longer at the head of the company.
And then you found an unlikely ally in Rupert Murdoch.
I did, yes. Rupert Murdoch and Peter Abels took over the company and the senior management pilots were still trying to do the wishes of Reg Ansett and to get rid of me. And they tried several different setups to do that. But no one knew that I had taught Rupert Murdoch's brother-in-law how to fly. So when it got a little bit awkward there at one stage and it was looking like they were not going to let me progress from ground school to actually flying one of the aircraft, I was able to give Rupert's brother-in-law a phone call and he then passed this message on to Rupert Murdoch, and then the following week he issued a memo to say that I was to be treated like all the other candidates. That was a very significant event.
And I imagine a great relief. So you flew for Ansett until the pilot strike of 1989 and then you moved to Europe to work there. What was it like there? Was it different?
Oh, Europe was totally different. I went to KLM and they already had about, I think, 15 or so women pilots. And there was no issue with that. It was just they were treated the same and they were treated not as being unusual. It was like they accepted them with open arms. So I wasn't unusual from the female point of view. I was unusual because I was an Australian.
And that's still the case, really, in a lot of places overseas, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're chatting with Deborah Laurie, who was the first female pilot with a major Australian airline, and Beverly Bass, who was one of the first female captains in the US. So, Beverly, meanwhile, you go from logging your hours to becoming the first female captain for American Airlines. How did those steps happen?
Well, I actually had quite a few flying jobs before I was in a position to interview with American. I flew for 5 to 6 years before that. And like Deborah, I flight instructed and I flew charter. and I flew night freight, so I had a lot of jobs. And then I, you know, received a letter that I was going to be interviewed by American. And I must say that I was treated so respectfully and wonderful the whole time throughout the whole process. And I didn't experience what Deborah went through. I can't even imagine that, to be honest with you. And I started out as a flight engineer on the 727 and just went through the normal progression that any of the pilots go through. And, you know, everything in the airline business for us is based on seniority. So when I was the third female pilot hired by American. And the only reason I was the first captain is it just worked out that way seniority-wise, because it's just when your turn is up, that's when you go to school. And so, you know, that was 10 years. I was hired in 76 and went to captain upgrade in 86. And then right after that, about 3 weeks later, had American's first all-female crew with American Airlines.
And that made huge news. You had reporters waiting for you on
it
the plane and on the ground.
And I was so surprised at that. You know, it's not something I anticipated. It was such a fun trip, though, because the conversation does change in the cockpit when you fly with only women. You talk about hair and makeup and nails, and you get to talk about girl things instead of what the guys flew in the Air Force.
And when you go crazy, when you're having your period, you can go crazy together.
Oh, yeah, right. We go so crazy.
Well, Beverly, what was your relationship like with the mainly female flight attendants when you first became a captain? Because I understand this might have been a bit confronting for some of the women in the industry as well.
Right. It wasn't when I became a captain. It was when I was first hired by the airlines. I honestly had more concerns about being accepted by the flight attendants because I had never worked with women before. And I was so fearful that they were going to think that I thought I was better than them or something like that. And some of them did initially, but I worked very hard to always include them. Like if we were all going to go out to dinner as a crew, I would always go back and talk to them first and invite them to dinner. And if it ever came to going out to dinner with the guys or going with the girls, I would go with the flight attendants because I wanted them to realize that in reality, I am one of them. I just happen to be a pilot, but I'm a girl first. So they gained so much respect for me as they did many of our female pilots, and they are some of my dearest friends today.
Let's go to September 11, 2001. You were flying a plane from Paris to Dallas with your feet propped on the dashboard, so it was a pretty cruisy flight, and then you got a call. Tell us how that unfolded.
It was. I was actually an instructor pilot on the 777, and the co-pilot I was flying with that day was on his IOE, which means he was on his initial operating experience trip. So it was his first time ever on the 777. And so, you know, it was a training flight. And we were just westbound from Paris to Dallas, right over the middle of the North Atlantic. And we are required to monitor air-to-air frequencies when we're over international waters. And so we're listening to that frequency, and that's when we heard that one of the towers had been hit by an airplane. Of course, you know, like many people, we thought it was a light airplane, and obviously that is tragic, but no one ever thought it was an airliner. And then about 20 minutes later, we heard the second tower had been hit, and at that time, they talked about it being an airliner as well as terrorism. But I honestly, I was so naive, I couldn't even wrap my head around what terrorism meant because I thought that was something that happened somewhere else in the world. It didn't happen on U.S. soil. So,
and later
it was a very odd day.
It must have been really extra strange as a pilot to realize that this had been the weapon of choice for those attackers.
Yes, but, you know, at that time, we didn't know any details. So, you know, we didn't know the airplanes had been hijacked. We didn't know who did it. We didn't know how they did it. And it was really many hours later before we learned any of that, because when we proceeded westbound, we were then ordered to land in Gander. And, you know, very few passengers had cell phones, and we didn't have a lot of contact with people in the U.S. at that time.
And you had nothing when you landed in Gander. You had to leave all your bags on the plane. How did the town rally round to help people at that time?
Well, the town was just amazing, and I think the first time I realized that was after we landed, which was about 10:15 in the morning on September 11th, and got the airplane parked. They came on and they said, "You will not be getting off to the next day. when we got off at about 7:30 in the morning on September 12th, we walked into the terminal, and I think that was the first time that I realized that we had landed in such an amazing place. The terminal, albeit a small terminal, was just lined with tables and tables of food, and it indicated to me that every stove in Gander had to have been operating all night long because they cooked enough food to feed 7,000 passengers and crew members. And we landed like in a three-hour time frame, so it happened pretty fast for them. And that's when I knew that we were in a very unique place.
And those unique events that took place in Gander have been turned into a hit Broadway musical, which is coming to Australia in July. It's going to be in Melbourne. It's called Come From Away, and one of the main characters is based on you, Beverly. Let's hear a little taste of that music.
Suddenly I got it.
So what's that like, Beverly, seeing someone up there on stage, being you and singing about these things that have happened to you?
Well, it's pretty amazing. And I must tell you, the first time we saw the show was in La Jolla in the summer of 2015 in California. And I didn't know that I was a prominent character in the show. And I had no idea that they had written a song that literally chronicled my aviation career. So, you know, my husband and I are sitting there front and center, and this show is happening. And within the first 5 minutes, we both had our heads buried in our hands, sobbing. And I guess we missed about 75% of the first show. But the good thing is we've seen it 126 times, so we've got it down pat now.
And Deborah, there's been no musical about your life story yet. This is Australia after all. It can only be an inevitability. And you're an icon right now here. Lots of women have come up to you over the years to thank you for what you've done. How does that feel to have that happen, but also to still be working in the industry?
When the girls come up to me, it makes me feel very humble. And many of them have done a lot of study, and they've done thesis, and I've said they've studied my court case, and they actually know quite a lot about me already. And that's a very strange feeling, I have to say. But it makes me feel very, very humble to know that they've gained inspiration from my case.
And do you think things have changed substantially for young women wanting to be pilots these days?
They have. If they're good enough, they'll get a go. Whereas in the past, some of them were better than good and still didn't get a fair go. But I feel these days the airlines are actively trying to encourage women to join the ranks. And so if they put their head down and do the work, they're going to get there.
That is a hugely encouraging place to be at the moment, this moment in time. Thank you both so much for chatting to Life Matters today about your journeys.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. Deborah Laurie is the first woman to become a pilot with a major Australian airline. She's currently a captain and instructor with Tiger Air Australia. She was inducted into the Victorian Honour Roll of Women in 2001, and she's been made a Fellow of the Royal Aeronautical Society and a Master Air Pilot. Beverly Bass was one of the first female captains in the US, and her story is told in a new musical called Come From Away. It's coming to Melbourne in July. And we're going to end with a part of a song from the musical, which tells Beverly story. It's called Me and the Sky.
And I got my first job flying for a mortician in a tiny bonanza, just a corpse and me. $5 an hour for flying dead bodies. I had to climb over their faces just to get to my spot.